And just trying to look at our agenda today and kind of lay out for those who are interested in these various bills, the order that we're going to take these. We'll first have a work session on introduction of speaker-approved measure drafting requests. We'll then move to House Bill 2813. That's the second one. Third will be House Bill 2444. Fourth is 2499. Fifth would be House Bill 3446. And then jump down to 3112 as the sixth bill. And then seventh will be House Bill 3093. And let's see. So we'll just see how we get through the 2 hours. And as a reminder to those who are new to the Rules Committee, is that we do bump up against another committee that meets at 3 p.m. Who are anxiously awaiting their convening today as well. So we're going to do what we can to get out just before 3 o'clock. So with that, let's open up a work session on consideration of speaker-approved measure drafting requests. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move the House Rules and Public Affairs Committee request the Legislative Council prepare the legislative drafts as presented in Speaker Minnis's letter dated April 14, 2003.
Thank you. Representative Flores has moved the House Rules and Public Affairs Committee request Legislative Council prepare legislative drafts as presented in a letter to Speaker Minnis dated April 14, 2003. Any discussion? Any objection? Not so ordered. And we'll close that work session and we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2813. Let's see. And members, we had no one signing up for this bill. This is something that we have worked in the past. Just the limited discussion that we have had on this bill is that since the public hearing on this bill is that the county clerks are having some concerns just because there is potential fiscal impact upon them to do this. Can call forward Fred Neal just to clarify.
Annette doing also Director of Election.
Oh. Yeah, that's fine, Annette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I know this isn't a work session, and I don't know what the committee's intentions are with it, but we did think that since we just spoke with the Legislative Fiscal Office this morning, and I understand you don't have a fiscal impact on this bill from them yet, and probably not because the counties did discuss this at length at their Legislative Committee meeting this morning and determined what procedurally would be required of them and how that would have some effect on them. I'm Fred Neal, one of the managers of the State Elections Division with the Secretary of State's office, and if you'll recall from the public hearing itself that the Secretary is opposed to this measure due to the impediment that it creates to voter registration in a timely fashion for citizens, since you must be a citizen to register to vote, and it is a Class C felony to sign a voter registration card stating you are a citizen if you are not. That is current law, that this measure is, in his words, a solution looking for a problem. The fiscal impact is what we'd like to address today, and the operational aspects of the research that would be required by each individual county in processing new registration cards. And my understanding is it would be each new registration card, because you'd have to ascertain, is this a voter who is voting, registering to vote for the first time in this state? Because we do not and will not for a number of years yet have a centralized voter registration system, each county receiving a registration card is going to have to check with the other 35 counties as well as their own internal system to determine if this is a new registration. And so that requires some additional procedure beyond what even the Help America Vote Act identification requirements that are new, and we have imposed them on all new registrations by mail new to a particular county or a brand new registration in this state since January 1st. And again, those are only registrations received by mail, which is about half of all voter registrations received at county elections offices. Then the second cost aspect of this is trying to process the registration card once within 7 days to get a notice to the would-be registrant of whether or not they're registered, and if not, if it's based on the lack of proof of citizenship, and processing that in a timely fashion. Again, that raises some policy issues for us about the 20-day registration cutoff. The bill says you're not registered to vote until the clerk mails you this notice confirming your registration or telling you why you're not registered. And when we get closer to a presidential election where thousands of registrations are being received daily, this becomes somewhat onerous and really means that the 20-day cutoff goes out the window to some extent, because the clerk's not going to get... It's going to be those that the clerk's mailed out, and if this bill took effect, that the clerk mailed out the card confirming the registration by the 21st day before the election in order to give them a ballot. So, Annette?
Well, just to clarify a little bit on the cards, we, like a general election, we received at one general election year prior to a presidential in Lane County, 10,000 registration cards in 3 days, the last 3 days that we were accepted. So that's, and all those cards, you actually have to go through and process them to determine which ones are new registration or not. So that's the time aspect that we talked about. And I don't know if Fred gave you a fiscal, the fiscal impact, but it's actually, we estimated in our meeting this morning, $500,000 for 1 year. And that's through the 36 counties, because you have to have more staff to be able to do that process. And that would be additional to the process we have for HAVA. HAVA, right at this point in time, we go ahead and register the people, and we can go and do the legwork after, and it doesn't affect the registration, where this would be, actually, we could not register the person without the proof of identification. So that would slow down that process, and some people we might not be able to get to. And by the 21st day, which could result in like 18-year-olds, that could be a factor. We get a lot of last-minute registration, especially before a presidential election.
So just to clarify, that the Help America Vote Act requires identification, which will have costs involved in that. This is just requiring proof of citizenship, just as HAVA requires identification. How do you distinguish the two?
Yeah.
The process is different on those particular two circumstances. And the one, like I explained before, the difference is number one, HAVA is for only those that are received through the mail. So it's not all registration. If people register in a drive or at an agency or in person, we do not need to require the proof of identification. So it's not all registration. Whereas on this particular circumstance, it would apply to all registration. So there is a larger impact to the cards that we would receive.
Can you,
the other,
can you clarify that, Fred?
Yeah, the other.
How is it HAVA does not require everyone to provide proof or
right.
ID?
Right. Under the Help America Vote Act, Mr. Chair, again, Fred Neal, in a vote-by-mail state, so that... So people aren't coming to the polls to vote for the first time, which is where the identification requirements for HAVA applies to other states, that in a vote-by-mail jurisdiction such as Oregon, the identification showing your name and address, your residential address, must accompany your voter registration card. If it does not, then the county is to treat your, we'll go ahead and register you, but treat your ballot as a provisional ballot pending receipt of that registration. And under the processes that we've adopted to implement that, the county then follows through with one or more letters asking for the ID, and then even after the election saying, you know, we've got a provisional ballot here, we still need that ID that you are going to send in a utility bill or the like. This bill, House Bill 2813, differs from HAVA in that it's making, under HAVA, the ID requirements are registration by mail that are new to that county, or just new, somebody just turned 18 and it's a new card, or they moved from Marion County to Linn County and they're updating their registration in Linn County. That, and they're doing it through the mail, they would have to provide identification. Under this bill, anyone registering to vote for the first time in this state would have to provide proof of citizenship before they could be registered. And so there's no treatment of a provisional ballot. Well, we'll go ahead and process it, and pending them coming up with the proof, or giving us time to research with the other counties to make sure that this is the first time in this state as opposed to the first time in Linn County. So there are substantive distinctions between how this bill is drafted and the processes that even Congress has imposed for identification for new registrants.
Okay. Questions?
I'd like to comment on the point, Mr. Chair. When you're ready, since it is my bill, I'd like to comment. I can go to the dais or whatever you'd like.
We were going to... I was looking, too, to get one additional comment from... another person to provide testimony. If you have a specific question, Representative Bonnehart.
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I may. Yeah. How many non-citizens have we had registered in Oregon in the last few years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonnehart, to our knowledge, none. We have not received any complaints that somebody has falsely sworn to their citizenship on a voter registration card in this state.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Mr. Drunkenmiller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, I lied. Last time I was here, I said I only come up once a year.
I knew we'd get that.
But this really is the first time I think I have come more than once. And I know we're not here really to give testimony. But I do appreciate the fact you're letting me address you.
If you could identify yourself as well.
Steve Druckenmiller. I'm the county clerk from Linn County. I cannot tell you how in favor I am of this concept of ensuring that only citizens get to vote. You know, the county clerks are the gatekeepers, last gatekeeper. So we all are concerned about this. I am... probably considered the farthest to the right that you can get for the County Clerks Association. And I want to say that I'm only speaking on my behalf here. And if there was a way of making this bill work, and I have given it great thought since that last meeting, I would share that with you. Can the concept work? Yes. It would require, though, I think, a number of changes in state government and cooperation with several agencies and laws. If I could just quickly tell you what I think that would entail. We're moving towards a centralized voter registration system in Oregon, and that is the first component. Another helpful component would be with the Department of Motor Vehicles. I know there's a bill about moving citizenship and residency requirements here, which would be a natural tie-in to establishing some of these things. One of the things that was not covered in the previous answer was, what is the difference between the HAVA requirements and what this bill would require? This bill requires proof of citizenship. The other HAVA requires proof of residency. And there's a vast... I could not come before you and prove to you I'm a citizen of the United States. My birth certificate was lost many, many years ago. And if I was going to register to vote, I wouldn't be able to vote. Because by the time I get a copy from the state of California, the election would be passed. And I have no... I'm not like the Secretary of State about being an impediment to people voting. I want to be an impediment to those who want to vote who shouldn't be voting. And this, however, I think would end up with more people not being able to vote who are legally entitled to vote than the number of people it would stop from voting. So that's the essence of what I wanted to share with you. But there is an overall concept where I think this could, in Oregon, work. But I'm afraid that it's not this bill. And if it was, I would be here telling you, yes. But the practical, technical implications of what the bill calls for, financially, and just procedurally with time, we would be in a difficult position to make it work. I couldn't make it work.
Okay, thank you. Representative Close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, I have several questions for you. You say you have a lost birth certificate. So I assume that means you don't have a passport, and I assume that means you had one at one time because you have a Social Security card. Is that correct?
Yeah. Unfortunately, in moves, all that stuff has been lost.
Okay. Can I ask you as a follow-up, Mr. Chair, are you willing to say that people shouldn't have to have a birth certificate for a passport or a Social Security card?
Well, no, and I think it's okay to ask for it for voting, too. But the difference is timing. Registration drives, people who want to register at the last minute. Now, that's different than if I want to plan a trip to Europe and I need to get a birth certificate.
Well, I think many of my friends that have almost missed trips overseas because of passport delays would probably think that they also had time constraints. But my point is that if it's important for those kind of documents, I think it's important to keep our election process fair and ethical. I wanted to ask you about HAVA. I can't remember the amount, but I believe it was $49 million that was going to come into our state to be put in a separate fund. Would that money, could that be used to implement this type of bill?
I'm no expert on it, but in my opinion, having served on the HAVA committee, no, it would not. You probably could make some tenuous argument that it should, but I don't think that would be keeping in the spirit with the letter of the law.
Even though HAVA does address this idea of proof when you're voting of who you are.
And that's for residency. And you know, you can bring in a utility bill, a rent receipt. Those are things that are readily available to people.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
But when they go to the poll, which we do not, mm-hmm. and they present their driver's license, which HAVA requires, right? They are showing ID, not a residency. They're showing your driver's license, which implies that they're a citizen.
I believe you can drive and not be a citizen.
You can in Oregon. Can you everywhere?
I don't know. In Massachusetts, you could. I could tell you that.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Close, do you have more that you have another statement you want to make? Or?
Well, just overall, I wanted to say that to me, our election process is just critical to our form of representative government. That's the form we have. We have a representative republic. And I believe we need to safeguard that. It's at the very core of our laws, which is why in our Oregon Constitution, Section 2, I believe it is, it says that you have to be a citizen to vote. It's already in our Oregon Constitution. So to say that we don't have the money to do this and this is cumbersome, we already have the requirement. We're just asking for verification. To me, that's worth the trouble and time that it would take to send in a copy. And again, this would be a copy. Wouldn't be the original, which Louisiana requires. They send it in an envelope with their card, and that does comply with the motor voter law, the federal law, that is allowable to request that ID when you register to vote. And Louisiana does that. So I would just ask you to give this your I vote. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I think we'll committee will stand at ease for about 5 minutes. Thank you. session on House Bill 2813, and the information from the county clerks, I think, at least on the fiscal issues, I'm needing more information on, and so I'm going to hold off a vote on this bill until we get some more information. My hope is that we can have legislative fiscal work with Representative Close over the next week and see about maybe a week from Thursday, that we would be able to bring this back. So if you can work under those time constraints and ask Mr. Hill and the county clerks to cooperate with that as well, be appreciated. So close work session on... before I do, I also wanted to make sure we entered in the record the email that was received today from the co-sponsors of this bill, Ruth Fendel and Mike Bellanese, and those should be at the members' desks.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2813. And we'll open up our public hearing on House Bill 2444. Mike Dewey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Mike Dewey representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. I hope there are fewer people testifying on this bill than a previous bill I brought you last week.
Well, as long as your testimony, you don't have the same kind of
I understand.
Emphasis on avoiding that opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for scheduling House Bill 2444. The Cable Association supports this bill. This may be somewhat surprising to some of you, but since 1987, the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission has been primarily funded through a tax on cable television customers. Ostensibly, the tax is on the distributor, and it's a 6% gross receipts tax on boxing and wrestling pay-per-view events. Now, these are the high-profile events. These are not minor events, and they don't come along very often, but a number of states prior to Oregon enacting legislation had passed some similar legislation. So we're not talking about subscription, HBO, or Showtime. The contracts that cable companies have with the distributor provide that if there is a state tax, that the distributor will be reimbursed from the cable operator once they make the payment to the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission. Now, it's fairly onerous in the sense that you have a 6% tax on the boxing and wrestling pay-per-view event. You have a 5% franchise fee. And if you take the cable bill in Portland, Oregon, for PEG access, these are the public access channels, you have another 3.64%. So the total on a $50, let's say, fight, for example, that's a 14.64% tax. So just to order that event at $7.31 for that particular tax, of which part goes to the Boxing and Wrestling Commission. Now, our competitor, and we talked about that previously, the DBS direct satellite providers do not have the same tax. They're not included in the statute. Ironically, when this measure passed in 1987, there were no boxing and wrestling events. The regulation was such that they were fairly onerous, and you couldn't get a license to promote an event, be it boxing or wrestling. So that kind of begged the question, why do you need the money? Now we do have some boxing and wrestling events. There was a high-profile fight at the Rose Garden. I'm not an expert on boxing or wrestling by any means, but I am an expert on this particular onerous tax. And the casinos, the Native American casinos, are having some boxing and wrestling events now, or boxing events. Now, let me say the public policy here today should be basically, how should this commission be funded? And we submit not on the backs of the distributor, the cable company, or the cable customer, because it's just too narrow and it doesn't make sense for somebody who is watching an out-of-state event to have to pay for the regulation of activities in the state of Oregon. So a few years back, we introduced legislation to repeal this particular onerous tax. We moved through the process. Unfortunately, Governor Kitzhaber had vetoed that legislation, and there wasn't really any reason for us to come back to the legislature, perhaps until we had an additional governor. But in the meantime, there have been a number of states that where this tax occurs across the country, California, Georgia, South Carolina, and some other states, where there have been lawsuits filed on First Amendment grounds. And let me say, it appears as though the Boxing and Wrestling Commission may have a little less to do. You passed some legislation recently defining wrestling as entertainment as opposed to the regulatory scheme over the Boxing and Wrestling Commission. So it appears as though their money needs are not as significant. But as I said, across the country, the pursuit of lawsuits on the constitutionality of this tax has been pursued. And in every case, the plaintiff, in this case, the distributor of these events, has prevailed. In 2001, in the Oregon Tax Court, TVKO versus LaRon Howland, who was the superintendent of state police, he was the defendant, and the court said, and I'll quote, "In summary, a tax imposed on television transmission of boxing matches held outside of Oregon violates the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution." Basically, going back, the United States Supreme Court has said that TV programmers, which provide news and entertainment and information, are engaged in speech and thus are a part of the press. And therefore, when you impose a tax on a narrow portion of the press, be it a television company, a cable company, and not on, let's say, a newspaper or a magazine who reports the same sort of events, is unconstitutional on First Amendment grounds relating to that narrow content. Now, the state needs to make, if they are to prevail, a compelling case or interest in safeguarding the health and welfare of the citizens, and I would submit, and so far they have not been able to do that in other states, you cannot make that case that you should solely put a tax on cable companies or the distributor, and that's why we brought the bill to you, in the sense that the courts have found, the Oregon Tax Court has found this unconstitutional. Now let me say, when I read you the decision of the Oregon Tax Court, I had received a memo from one of the lawyers who litigated this and said we won, and a couple days later they called back and said, well, we've reread this opinion, and it says that the out-of-state events are unconstitutional. And so they felt as though they needed to clarify this, and this has now been appealed to the Oregon Supreme Court to clarify that both in-state and out-of-state events are unconstitutional. That is going to be heard, I believe, on May 7th of this year before, the Oregon Supreme Court. And I could not figure out or find a distinction in terms of why an in-state event would be constitutional in terms of that narrow content as opposed to an out-of-state event. But nonetheless, that is going to be litigated, and so we're before you to remove the language in the statute. The Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission is not collecting the money because it has been found to be unconstitutional. I would say, as I close, that it would seem to make sense that if we're now having some events, there is a 6% live gate, and that would be constitutional because people are going to see the event. And also I would say that and submit that it would be very important to be sure that the promoter pays their fair share for the regulation, because they are benefiting from this particular regulation because they're able to put on a boxing match or a wrestling match. So with that, I will close, and I hope you will consider today and pass out this bill, House Bill 2444. And Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, who is your major competitor?
The major competitor for cable companies would be direct broadcast satellite companies, DirecTV,
okay.
EchoStar,
right.
And other, the construct of the statute, they do not pay the tax.
Okay. And when we have, I'll follow up. When you have to pay specially for, like, the Blazer games, is that something entirely different?
It's in, Mr. Chair and Representative Monis Anderson, it is entirely different. This only applies to a boxing match. Now, it's pay-per-view. These are Holyfield versus Tyson the WFFA, those kinds of things, which are fairly expensive, a one-time expenditure, a one-time event, and the 6% that is collected by the distributor or the cable company, paid to the distributor, funds in portion the Boxing and Wrestling Commission.
Other questions for Sam Barnhart?
Thank you, sir. Is the does the commission get sufficient revenue from these other sources that we talked about to pay their bills?
Representative, Mr. Chair and Representative Barnhart, I have not taken a look at their budget recently. When we got first involved in this, since they did not have any events, okay, and they were losing general fund money, you can imagine that somebody tried to find another way of funding it, and that was this particular 6% tax. Obviously, we opposed that. We were not successful in 1987. We were later, but again, the governor came into play. There is a provision that their revenues went like this, up and down, depending on the magnitude of the fights, how compelling a fight was. So they saw revenues, you know, I would speculate, it was very difficult to know how much money would come in, because you may have three events, zero events, depending on the market and the characters, I use that word lightly, involved. And then they had a provision that a portion, if there was a certain kind of reserves, went to another account. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yes.
But they are not relying on this revenue today. And even if there have been no in-state pay-per-view events, and there will not be, it's just not a compelling reason to have that. And I know Showtime and HBO wouldn't, if the in-state stayed, which I don't think it will, obviously it comes out on this particular bill, they're not going to have any events in Oregon to begin with, which isn't really good for economic development or recreation of the state.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. When we passed the bill the other day that said wrestling and boxing became entertainment, there was also in there it no longer would be regulated by the commission. Are we talking about the same group, the same commission?
Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, yes, we are. It's the we really don't have any wrestling events. The rules in Oregon are fairly onerous for somebody to get licensed. There are certain requirements and so forth. And so under the proposal, if it passes, the commission is probably going to be the Oregon Boxing Commission, because they're not going to have regulatory authority over the wrestling side.
And just to clarify, the bill that was passed by our chamber last week was only for the entertainment, the wrestling, and boxing was not part of that bill. It's only that wrestling.
Entertainment wrestling.
Yes. Yeah, entertainment wrestling, as opposed to, you know, the professional sports.
Okay.
The boxing.
Yeah, I would submit, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and I think it's important to regulate a boxing event for health purposes and those sorts of things. I think that's an important state interest. It's taking a narrow portion of the population and saying you have to fund that regulation when they have nothing to do with the sport at all. That's the problem.
And then to clarify, Mr. Dewey, our staff manager summary says there may be a revenue impact and fiscal impact with this bill. Can you enlighten us?
Mr. Chair, I'd be very happy to do that. As it stands now, the Boxing and Wrestling Commission is not collecting. If there is a pay-per-view event for Oregon cable customers to buy, they are not collecting the 6% because the tax is unconstitutional. There are no in-state events, so if they read this in such a way that they were going to collect money on a pay-per-view event that was held in Oregon at the Rose Garden, a boxing match, and it was on pay-per-view. It wasn't on Showtime or HBO, but you'd pay $50 one-time thing to see it. There aren't any of those. So they are not anticipating, and I talked to the chair of the Public Safety Committee about that in their budget, and they are not anticipating receiving any of these funds. We are merely just taking something that's unconstitutional off the statute.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, Representative Lance Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why did the governor, previous governor, veto this bill?
Mr. Chair, I cannot answer that. He did veto some other bills of mine, so it wasn't the only one. I suspect it was saying, well, if we can't use this source of revenue and we're not having any events for the live gate, then it's going to have to come from somewhere in probably the general fund. Now, you know, I submit that they probably don't need as much money as they used to need based on the wrestling side. But I can't get into the mind of the governor.
Good answer.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you for your consideration.
And there's no one in the room scheduled to testify in opposition? No? I wasn't going to say anything. Okay. Let's go ahead and close the public hearing, and then we can open up a work session on House Bill 2444. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2444 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Flores has moved House Bill 2444 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Close.
Mr. Chair, the summary says may have revenue impact, may have fiscal impact, no statement issued. I'm a little uncareful voting for something. I don't know what the impact of it is. Do we have any information at all?
Only what we just received from the testimony of Mr. Dewey, that it was considered negligible by the folks that he's spoken to. So, Mr. Dewey, can get you to come back one more time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Close. The gentleman sitting over here, I didn't realize, was with the commission. And he just told me that they are not intending to collect this revenue. It's a moot point as far as they're concerned. He did say they intend to, a degree, regulate wrestling in the state, so if I misspoke in terms of what their responsibilities are. But again, they can't collect this revenue based upon a court case. So it's, I think, moot.
Thank you.
And I would suggest to committee members, if for some reason a fiscal or a revenue impact statement comes out that's pretty significant, we can always bring the bill back to committee to deal with it. Thank you. Other discussion? Okay. Let's call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. And bill passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any carrier volunteers? I guess the chair will keep. Oh, Representative Backlund. It's the carrier. Thank you. That closes the work session on House Bill 2444. And we'll now open up public hearing on House Bill 2499. Representative Nelson. Welcome.
Thank you, Representative and Chairman Doyle, members of this distinguished committee. I appreciate this opportunity to appear before you today to explain the critical need for House Bill 2499. And the timing couldn't be more appropriate. We realize that today is April the 15th, our favorite day of the year to give our money away. We only had the choice of where we could go. Prior to taking my first term of office here in the legislature and in the continuum, the issue stated in House Bill 2499 has continued to be the primary need of state government, as validated by vast news stories, the governor's inaugural address, numerous political campaigns, constituent requests, and those employed in service to the citizens of the state of Oregon. Therefore, I'm here today to ask your concurrence that we take the bold, decisive, and essential step in defining the priorities of state services and establish designated funding for those critical services. As we all know from our personal lives, we must take care of the basic needs of our families before other non-essentials. We know we must always maintain a contingency fund for the unexpected. We also know the best place to be is in an unencumbered financial position with minimal debt in order to maximize the value of our income from our hard work. Most importantly, to live wholesomely within our means brings the greatest peace of mind. I believe state government can and will function the same way if we take the time to firmly establish state service priorities with designated funding sources for each. Opinions vary as to what those should be. In my mind, this is done by asking, one, what brings the greatest needed benefits to the well-being of our people if we perform certain functions? And what constitutes the greatest critical liabilities to the well-being of our people if we do not provide certain services? Secondly, what services are most efficiently, effectively, and economically performed by public entities over those available or that could be available through private enterprise, volunteer, and nonprofit organizations? And next, what is the best use of our citizens' investments with taxes, with fees, and other assessments? And how do we bring the best return to them on those investments? What security do we have in place to protect those defined and prioritized services in tough economic times? First, it is clear that we have constitutional requirements that must be met. A safety and a justice system, with provisioning for full-time employment for prisoners, proper custodial care for our foster children, K-12 education funding, PERS management, and state and federal mandates ranging from employment and certain health care requirements to clean air and a quality environment. Secondly, and beyond those constitutional requirements, it is the desire of the majority of our people that we provide certain essential services for those we deem the most fragile of our society. We can prioritize in both the first and second categories. We can also designate specific funding sources for both categories. We can also add a third category of a contingency fund for future protection of the priorities we establish. The obvious results and the rewards of this process are: one, we meet our constitutional and legal requirements. Two, we provide critical services for those due to severe fiscal or physical limitations who cannot obtain the help they need through private providers and whose services are most economically and efficiently handled by publicly financed services through large volume purchasing. Three, we live within our means. Certainty is good. Once we establish the most critical priorities and how we can most conservatively pay for them, we no longer have the uncertainty we have now. Our citizens understand that. They live this life. They will appreciate our standards. They know what consumer debt, credit card interest, and trying to maintain champagne tastes on a beer budget do to a family's feeling of financial security. 4, we plan our work our plan, inspect what we expect through performance measurement, sustain regular review of results, maintain agility and the ability to adjust to changing needs through a priority upgrade process. We prevent pork and non-essentials in budgeting. We know with the clarity of zero-based budgeting that every spent cent is counted in our accountability to these priorities. And 5, we then can concentrate on a healthier economy, be creative and innovative in maintaining a sound economic base for our Oregon family. We can face each tomorrow positively because we have participated in proper, prudent, prior planning that produces powerful performance without compromise. Please support House Bill 2499. Together is a wonderful place to be. Together means quality, agility, safety, security, reliability, accountability, fiscal responsibility, and priority. Thank you for your support.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Moss Sampson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, have you talked to any of the co-chairs and asked them if they use some of this? I would hope that they would, but...
Thank you very much for that question, Chair Doyle and Representative Moniz Anderson. In the budgeting process, there is some hope that we are prioritizing. There is no specific prioritization anywhere. Further, we sent a message to all departments of state government, therefore, and we ask each agency to define what should be the top priorities. And I have in my possession here those lists as deemed prioritized by various agencies. Our next step is through a query of state citizens to see if they concur with the agency's decision for prioritized services. Naturally, there will always be some situations in which, just like we do now, in which certain pet projects, whether it's a library at Southern University or OPB or a cultural trust or other like type programs like Head Start or special interests. But what this process does, it causes us to ask, what can we do within our means to meet the most critical needs for the citizens? Not that these other ideas are not great ideas, but are they ones that we deem most critical to the benefit of the well-being of our citizens, as well as prevent liabilities for those very same individuals? That's why in the preparation of the bill by Legislative Council, originally we asked, how can we do this? You know, how can we query 3.5 million people? You know, somebody could do it for the two-year-olds and ask them, and somebody for the those who may not even speak English or be able to see any longer. But this is where we felt that we could be confident in requiring a joint legislative committee
on ways and means to set up the system through which these are well defined. And also, as I mentioned in my testimony, in which we have the process for upgrading our priority system as times change. For example, the next time we're hit with a spotted owl and lose massive dollars that were previously used for financing critical services, education, and other services. Mr. Chair, if I might add one more point to that. What personally I felt would be just the most marvelous of marvelous situations, representing Miles Anderson, would be for every senator and every representative to query their constituents and come back with this list. Could be done in a very short time frame. We could be sure that the budget that we're preparing, even in this session, meets those critical needs. Then I think that also prevents the guilt we all feel when we cannot meet every single solitary need of our citizens. But it also helps us identify those, and as we just did this last week in my community, find or establish nonprofit and volunteer organizations that can meet those other needs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say that going into this session in January, the state of Washington actually did this. And I tried to send to them to get their information, how they were doing it. They were apparently one of the first in the country to do priority-based budgeting, so it's a new concept, and I wasn't able to get much information from them. But other states are doing it.
Yes. Good point. Other comments, questions, the representative?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Close.
I will just do a follow-up to Representative Close's comment Governor Locke indeed is involved in core function evaluation for their government, and which involves then a priority listing after they determine the core functions. So it is not such an abstract concept that many states are starting to come along with the same drill.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. Oh, do you have something further?
Mr. Chair. I would just like to say that while I appreciate very much your giving me this opportunity to speak to this bill, I think it's very critical that we take it upon ourselves to move when we need to. And when we're number one in hunger in this state, and have been now for 4 years, I'd call that a priority. And when we're number one in unemployment or a close second, I think that's a critical need. And when we have 10,000 students becoming dropouts every year, just figure that's $400 million of education lost every year in this state. And those children could be saved perhaps by the discipline in the Oregon Guard program in Bend, or when we spend multiple dollars over children who repeat grades, at, depending on if you're from a rural area where you get $5,500 a student or $11,000 in a large Portland area perhaps, or $9,000 a student. Every time there's a repeat, it lets me know that that child should have started way back before first grade. And for us to be discriminating with those children, those disadvantaged children who will drop out, who will be behind forever, that to me should be a priority. I sincerely hope, and I actually beg this committee to seriously consider this bill and please vote on behalf of prioritizing state funding for specific issues that are the greatest benefit and prevent great liabilities to our people.
Thank you. Thank you for testimony. Let's see, Don Schellenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. I'm going to make a confession here. I'm going to tread on dangerous ground. When I first read the summary of the bill, it struck a chord, and I think I can summarize in four lines possibly what Representative Nelson was just saying. In our Farm Bureau policy, it says the state budget should reflect a responsible fiscal attitude with an emphasis on minimizing unnecessary or non-productive programs and strengthening those programs which will enhance the economics of the state. I think that's what Representative Nelson's bill is driving at. That's certainly what Farm Bureau is interested in. My confession is I haven't read the bill. I read the summary, and the summary looked really good to me, and so I'm trusting LC that they wrote a correct summary of the bill. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll ask the committee to support the bill based on if the bill, in fact, does what I believe it does. Thank you.
Okay. First, was there a question, Representative Berger, of that ringing endorsement?
No, I was just going to make a comment, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
All right. Well, I'm sorry that I was so slow in making my comment, and Representative Nelson left. I think that there's a lot of idealism in the bill, and there's not anything wrong with that. I think that when people come to the legislature, they come hoping that they can have a sense of fairness and that they can participate in a process that they're very proud of. And I think in trying to rid a process of things that are not right, that are perhaps unfair, or that, as she refers to pork, and some of the things that we would like to see, a pure and clean process, and also the lack of funds at this point, I think, emphasize the need for prioritizing, which she mentions in the bill as well. And with all of its idealism, I do applaud the effort to put down on paper what I guess I used to have someone tell me, reach for the stars. And I think this is a bill that probably reaches for the stars, but there's no harm in that.
Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, will there be other witnesses?
No, that's it.
I noticed that Mr. Chernoff is in the audience, and I have a legal question to ask, if he wouldn't mind. And I'll tell you even what the question is before you agree to answer it. I'd like to know whether the term law, as used in line 10 of this bill, includes law, the laws and the Constitution, or if it's more narrow than that.
Mr. Chamoff, can you come forward, please? I understand this is one of your bills that you drafted?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Greg Chamoff, Legislative Council, let's see, in answer to the chair's question, yes. In answer to Representative Barnhart's question, yes. In this context, law would also include a constitutionally imposed obligation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further? Okay. Committee note that this does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So we will... any other questions about it? No? Let's then go ahead and close the public hearing, and we will open up a work session on House Bill 2499. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move that we move this bill with a due pass and be referred to Ways and Means.
Okay. Representative Flores has moved House Bill 2499 with a due pass recommendation and a referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. The reason I asked the question is because I wanted to find out whether our obligation under the Oregon Constitution to fund schools adequately, a la Measure 1, would be a law under the purpose of this statute, and it sounds like it is, and I think it's important for the committee to think about if we really mean to be serious about complying with our obligations under law and contract, including that provision, because it would significantly change the priorities as I think they are now in the budgetary process. I'm not saying I disagree with the change, but I think the committee ought to be warned that I think that's the implication of this language.
Thank you. Anything further? Okay, let's call the roll.
Representative Zachman?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative
Coates? Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair
Aye. And we, House Bill 2499 then will pass with a referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. And that closes our public or our work session on House Bill 2499. We'll now open up a public hearing on House Bill 3446. Mary, we have. I think some there's a fiscal statement on this bill, and we have legal counsel here to provide answers to questions that we may have on this bill. Sponsored by the Committee on Revenue, however, we've not located the actual proponent of this bill so that it would, you know, to get some additional information. So what I was hoping is that we could ask legislative counsel to go ahead and step forward and just give us a brief summary and maybe some of the, at least the legal origin of this bill, and then answer any questions you may have.
Mr. Chair, members, Greg Chamov, Legislative Council. The origin of House Bill 3446 is the allotment lawsuit that those of you who were here for the special sessions may recall. The previous governor, when faced with a shortfall in general fund revenues, had the Department of Administrative Services adopt a rule that made specific budget cuts, changing the spending priorities that the Legislative Assembly had made. At the direction of the Legislative Council Committee, our office participated in a lawsuit that challenged the validity of the department's rules, contending that the statute that permitted the budget cuts did not permit the governor and the department to make specific budget cuts, but were cuts that had to follow the Legislative Assembly's spending priorities. The case was ultimately dismissed as moot. However, given that there may still be a dispute over what the allotment statute says, part of House Bill 3446 is to make it clear, and here I'm referring to page 2, lines 5 through 10, which is it's the key language for your purposes, that when the governor is having the Department of Administrative Services cut budgets when there's a shortfall, the governor and the department need to be following the priorities set by the Legislative Assembly and not setting the governor and the department's own priorities. In the course of the allotment lawsuit, the Attorney General's office made the argument that when the Legislative Assembly provides funds to an agency to operate a program, that the agency could, in its discretion, decide not to spend the money that the Legislative Assembly had provided to the agency. So, for example, if an agency had come in and requested $100,000 to run a daycare center, the legislature provided an appropriation for $100,000. The agency could later decide that the daycare center was a bad idea and not spend the $100,000, even though the legislature had anticipated that there would be that spending. On page 1, lines 14 through 17, you will find a direction to agencies that says, essentially, if you go to the legislature asking for money and the legislature gives it to you, you will use the money for what the legislature gives you the money, except if you can achieve the purposes of that money for some savings. So that would prevent an agency from getting an appropriation and then, as a result of some dispute over the underlying policy, declining to spend the money provided.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yes.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Does this mean, thank you, that if the governor, we have a budget shortfall, and the governor does not want to reduce any money through K through 12, but wants to, but sees that the university systems or community colleges could reduce ask them to reduce their budget. Is this what this is preventing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, in our view, the law already prevents the governor from doing that, or rather the law does not give the governor that authority. However, the previous governor, at least at one point during his administration, took the position that the statute did authorize him to do that. The purpose of this bill is to make it completely clear, not subject to having to go back to court to get the question decided, that the governor does not have that authority.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A different kind of question. There have been a number of bills up before the Revenue Committee lately to fix things that we tried to do last time. One of the most recent ones had to do with issuing tax credits in favor of child care. And there were apparently problems with the way the bill was drafted so that the legislative intent couldn't be carried out either within the financial system or the legal system. I'm not sure which. And we're in the process of writing a new law in order to fix those technical problems. Does this language pose a problem in that situation? Or in effect, what happened, the Attorney General said you can't do that. Legislature needs to fix the law. But this language would seem to say, well, you've got to spend the money anyway. Is that a potential problem with this bill, or am I, or is there something else that saves the agency that's stuck in that situation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I'm not sure that I'm sufficiently clear on the example that you're providing to be able to answer the question. It would seem to me that if there is a separate legal impediment to an agency's authority to spend money, that this bill would not override that.
Okay.
The additional clarity would still be required. The purpose of this bill is not to prevent the fixing of problems, but to prevent the executive department from having the authority to disagree with the legislature's policy choices.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you, sir. Let's See, there's no others to testify on this bill, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3446. And the committee will stand at ease for just a moment. At our committee, and let's open up a work session on House Bill 3446.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3446 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved House Bill 3446 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Members, I think the information that we received from Legislative Council basically is that this is merely an attempt to codify the position that the legislature already has maintained. It just provides a little bit more substantiation to that position. And you'll notice in the fiscal analysis proposed by our legislative fiscal office, the very last line is that they think it might be a good idea to have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. What I would like to do is move the bill on the House side and let the Senate make the decision to give it a referral to the Ways and Means process. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, sir. And that makes sense to me, given where we are. I would note that one of the things the Senate might consider is changing the word need on line 19 of page 1 to may. Seems to me if the state agency can fulfill its responsibilities without spending all its money, then it shouldn't be allowed to spend all its money.
Okay. Duly noted. Further discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
First item, Mark Sanderson.
I don't pretend to know everything that, regarding the ramifications of this. My yes vote will be on the basis that on the surface this bill sounds okay, but I'm not sure, as I said, the ramifications.
Okay.
And it would have helped to have the governor's input on this, too, the governor's office.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not comfortable with the bill. Be happy to give you a courtesy vote if you'd like to have that to go to the floor. I'd be more comfortable with a no vote, and I don't think you're going to need my vote.
Okay. Very well. Nothing further?
Mr. Chair, I think the committee needs to know that we are repealing 291.254, which talks about DAS being able to, at any time, that the receipts from taxes fall short, they can readjust that with the approval of the governor. So it's a small section, but I think it's important that the committee knows it.
Committee members, you may wish to look at the staff measure summary that's been prepared by our administrator that identifies the actual statute that is being repealed. And is there further need for explanation of that?
Well, Mr. Chair, the statute that Representative Close points out, it doesn't say this, but it would appear to give DAS the authority to reduce an agency's budget, reduce the amount allotted to prevent or to be allotted so as to prevent a deficit with the approval of the governor. So it appears that their current law, maybe there's something else that modifies this I don't know about, but it would appear that our current law does allow DAS to reduce an agency's budget with the governor's consent in the event of a deficit, and that this may in fact be new policy. Now, obviously Mr. Chamoff has a comment on that.
Mr. Chamoff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, the statute that this bill repeals and that you are discussing is the statute that was at issue in the lawsuit.
I figured.
So,
thank you for raising.
The governor's office certainly took the position that you are espousing now. It's our view that that statute can't be read that way, that you have to link the deficit to the particular source of income, so that if, for example, the gas tax revenues come up short, then ODOT's budget could be reduced, but not other agencies. But when you have unprioritized general fund shortfall that covers all agencies, the statute doesn't intend and couldn't constitutionally give the governor the authority to decide which generally funded agencies would get money and which ones wouldn't. And so by repealing that statute and replacing it with what's in House Bill 3446, you would prevent the governor from being able to pick and choose between generally funded agencies when there's an overall shortfall.
Okay, that raises a question for me then, Mr. Chair, if I may. Thank you. Then is there some other provision in 3446 to deal with the deficit that results from a specialized fund coming up short in order to replace that aspect of ORS 291.254?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, Section 2 of the bill still allows that to happen, yes. So it keeps the shortfall in a specific fund part, but requires essentially across the board, if there is no other prioritization by the legislature in general fund appropriations.
Representative Backman.
I see. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I support this bill because I think it maintains the philosophy of separation of powers. As we know, the Congress or the legislature passes bills or laws, and the executive carries them out or enforces them. So I think it's clear in our case, if we appropriate monies for programs, we expect those programs to be executed. And I would think it's the responsibility of the governor to do that. So I support this bill. I think it's the right thing to do because we did have some confusion in a special session.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Close, did you have something?
No.
Okay.
One other question, if I may, Mr. Chair. Let's suppose that the legislature, in a biennium like the one we're in now, where, you know, what the revenue is actually going to be is a number we can pick out of the air and probably be wrong about, decided that we would set a priority for where cuts would be made by DAS or the governor. We could still do that in spite of having a statute like this, could we not? By law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, this bill assumes that in the event you've done that, DAS and the governor will follow you. So, yes, okay. We could still do that.
I mean, we could say, well, if we're going to make cuts, we're going to cut it here first, and then here second, and then here over here third. And despite the language in this bill, they would still be required to follow that specialized statute for that biennium.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, this bill would make them follow that specialized.
I got it. Thank you.
Okay, further.
And just one more question. Thank you. If in May the revenue forecast was way down, we didn't have the monies that we thought we were going to have. We only have a month or two where we needed to make a payment to the school system, but the money's not there. Are you saying then that we would have to reconvene so that we could allot money to, say, the schools? I mean, we didn't get it through revenues. I mean, in those last-minute conditions, we would take the power away from Dasser, the governor, and we'd have to call the session in to figure out how to make that payment. Are you seeing the gist of where I'm going with this question?
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, I think I see the gist. I don't think that this bill affects the situation that you're describing. You know, if, we'll say in May 2004, there is another shortfall and there isn't enough money for all of the general fund appropriations, then under this bill, and as the law currently, we believe, reads, the governor and the department would have to follow the legislature's spending priorities, so that if you had passed a bill that says fund public schools first and then give everybody else an across-the-board cut with what's left, the governor and the department would have to do that. Typically, the legislature hasn't done that. There have just been general fund appropriations made, and under this bill, if you continue to do that, the permissible way of balancing the budget, accounting for the shortfall, would be to make an across-the-board cut in general fund revenues, in spending to match the amount of the revenue. So you wouldn't have to come back in and reconvene, except if you wanted to make a change in priorities other than across the board. Because when you've made just across-the-board appropriations, in our view, the law currently and in this bill, the only kind of cuts the governor and the department could make would be across the board.
Okay, thank you. Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If House Bill 3446 had been in effect a year ago and we ran into the shortfall following the 01 session, we ran into the shortfall, would we have not come back in special sessions, but rather the projected deficit in the biennium would have been handled here with the approval of the governor, and if it had not cut one state agency, it could have done across-the-board cuts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, House Bill 3446, if it had been in effect during the special sessions when you were dealing with the shortfalls, wouldn't have created any different response than we think the law already reads. The governor could then, and under the bill, could have then cut general fund spending across the board. You came back in various special sessions because, at least it was my observation, that as a matter of policy, the Legislative Assembly did not want to make across-the-board cuts of the magnitude that the shortfall required, that the Legislative Assembly chose to exercise its policymaking authority to obtain additional monies for the state to use and to spend those additional funds, some places more than others. But under the law that, as we believe it to be correctly interpreted, and under House Bill 3446, the governor could have simply made across-the-board cuts in the amounts necessary to balance the budget. This won't change the law as we believe it applies. All it will do is prevent a governor in the future from killing one generally funded program to save another one when the legislature has funded them both.
Okay.
I'll just simply note, Mr. Chair, that the additional conversation and additional discussion questions make me feel a great deal more comfortable about the bill than I did before we had that additional conversation. And I appreciate Representative Close having brought up that statute and having given us a chance to talk about it. I understand the controversy a lot better now.
Okay, thank you. I believe there's a motion already, so let's go ahead and call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Aye.
Representative
Flores. Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Burgess. No. And Chair Noel. Aye. And the House Bill 3446 passes with a recommendation to pass at the floor. Carrier, anybody interested? Okay. The chair will carry this one. And we will close the work session on 3446. And colleagues, just diverting a little bit from our agenda, we're going to move real quickly in a work session on House Bill 3093. Open that up. Colleagues, in your materials today, there is the Dash 3 amendments. Dash 3 amendments have taken into account the questions that the committee had at our last public hearing about whether we wanted to expand the public record exceptions to include email addresses and home addresses and phone numbers. This amendment actually deletes that exception and instead only focuses on the original intent that the individual proponent had, which was only to grant the the privacy of the email addresses to those who request it in concerns for public safety or other emergencies. At the time, then, just as information as well, you'll see on section, on page 2, there's a highlighted in bold on lines 11 through 15 is a proposal that was made by the Public Utilities Commission, and Commissioner Beyer is here to answer questions if you have any. But ultimately, the idea was that this bill contained a relating clause that would help in making it so that the current requirement is that whenever there is a meeting held, the minutes must be transcribed. And this, what this amendment does is remove the requirement for the transcription, but still require that they have to maintain recordings. And then they would then be required to transcribe recordings whenever they are being requested. So the whole idea is that they're not automatically transcribing minutes that are never been looked at. And it's not just for the PUC, of course, but it's for all governing bodies. And then finally that they're able to charge a fee for preparation of the transfer for that recording. There is one final amendment that I had hoped we would have in today, but we needed to clarify some drafting issues, and that was at the request of OHSU, and the Dash 2 amendment, which you also have at your desk, was the first try at it. It's just not. It's just too broad, or a lot broader than what I think anyone had anticipated. So we are going to hold over till Thursday the full HSU amendment. I still wanted to at least get the DAS-3s adopted so that, you know, those issues can be dealt with today, and then we'll look to work session the bill on Thursday after we get the OHSU amendment. So with that, take it.
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the DAS-3 amendments to House Bill 3093.
Okay. Representative Flores has moved adoption of the DAS-3 amendments to 3093. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Representative Close.
This has to do with the recording of minutes and then charging a fee for that. And I thought that the bill was dealing with email addresses, so I'm just wondering why we have this new amendment that doesn't deal with email addresses.
The relating clause on House Bill 3093 is relating to public records, and this provided an opportunity for this amendment to come in under that provision.
Can I ask whose amendment it is?
That was the Public Utilities Commission.
Okay, thank you.
And I assume the point of it is efficiency. It reduces costs because you don't have to subscribe
everything. Yeah. We'll have Commissioner Beyer speak to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barnhart, that is exactly the point of this. We discovered it in our shop, and I think, frankly, from my experience serving on local councils, and that's the same thing, is technology has changed. It costs a lot of money to create minutes that nobody reads, and I actually think the quality with the recordings that we have now probably can provide better information to those who want that than the minutes. In our specific case, what we found over the years, particularly since I've been there, I've noticed that when somebody wants a written record of what we're doing, it usually is because they don't like a decision we've made and they want to go to court, and they really don't want minutes. They want a transcript, and we provide that now. In terms of the charging, that's already an existing law. You can, in fact, the open meetings law provides that you can charge for copies as it is now. I think our original concept was we would be willing, in our case, in lieu of charging for and keeping minutes, we'd just as soon give somebody a copy of the tape if that's what they wanted, and they could listen to it and do what they want. Others raised objections, said they'd like to have the same provision that exists in law today to say you can recover our cost of producing that. I think that's where that piece of it came from.
Okay.
But I actually think you end up with the public gets the option of having a better reflection of the meeting that they have interest in with a recording than they do with somebody's summary minutes of it.
And Commissioner, if we can just get you to identify yourself.
I'm sorry. Lee Beyer, Commissioner with the Oregon Public Utility Commission.
Thank you, sir. Okay, further discussion? Okay. Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Okay, and that'll close work session on House Bill 3093, and with the expectation that OHSU will have their amendment by Thursday, and we can get this moving. Let's see. Open up public hearing on House Bill 3112. Representative Post, go to the dais, please. To the podium.
And Mr. Chair, while Representative Post is coming up, we have a letter from Department of Human Services at your place. I asked to be entered in the record. She did.
Okay. The Department of Human Services letter. Without objection, will be entered into the record. And just a note, members, we're now about 17 minutes to 3 o'clock, and I guess the good news is that after Representative Close has finished testifying, those who are going to testify after her will all be staying for the PERS committee anyway, so we're not going to be... Oh, I beg your pardon, there will be one not doing that. Okay, Representative Close.
Thank you, Chair Doyle, and members of the House Rules and Public Affairs Committee for hearing House Bill 3112. It was requested by my husband, Chris Close, who is unable to be here because he works in Portland. His thoughts on the bill are as follows, and I've tried to make this as succinct and brief as I can. Illegal drugs are a huge problem in our culture. We have youth programs like DARE to discourage illegal drug use among our children. We should also ensure that people who work with the young impressionable youth are drug-free in order to set a good example. House Bill 3112 allows, and it is not a mandate, it just allows public institutions to conduct drug testing of public employees who have contact with children if they wish to, and the employer pays that cost. I would like to add that the practice is common in private industry. Even in sales management, my husband is required to take these tests as a condition of employment, and that would be, of course, much more far-reaching than this bill, which just allows it in various cases. Several states have these laws. We researched it with three states, including Florida's 2001 Drug-Free Workplace Act, Arizona, and also Georgia, and we have modeled this bill on their state statutes. I urge you to equip our agencies with this important option so as to protect our children. The main points of the bill, as you can see, it's just a one page, two sides, and there's several definitions. There's a written policy that's given out before this drug testing is done. It allows the agencies to do pre-employment testing if they choose to. The employer pays for that. There's confidentiality, and there's an appeals process. And if you look on the back, you can see in Section 4 it talks about if they do take action against the person, what their appeals are under the Act. I'd like to address the letter that came from the Department of Human Services. They did not give this letter to me. I received it with you today, which I think is unfortunate because I could have addressed some of their concerns if I had had the time. At any rate, they're talking about, they're concerned about just limiting it to people who work with children. I was told by legislative counsel that the way our Constitution reads, that the courts have ruled that you could do this type of testing to protect children, but that you could not do it, you could not extend it beyond that. And so that's why we have narrowed this bill to protect children, although I do understand that, as they point out, people who work with seniors, you know, they have those concerns as well that they be drug tested, but that is not the intent of this bill, and it's my understanding that we cannot do that under our laws. They also address that they want to define contact with children. That's a good point. I'm not against that. They also bring up the fiscal on this, and I want to make it clear that this is a bill that does not require drug testing. It's only if people choose to do so in their agencies. So the intent is that this allows them that. They would have to allow for that in their budgeting process. They would have to budget for it, or they could choose not to budget for it. So it would not be our responsibility to have additional funds to do that. But it would give them the opportunity, if they had a problem and there was concern based on evidence, they could do this with selected people. It would not be random across the board. And that's what other states have done, too, such as Florida. It just allows it in certain instances. I think that the fiscal would be negligible. I don't know that they could determine the fiscal because, again, it's only done by choice. But you don't have a population that you can determine the cost of it is and multiply it by that population because it would be at their discretion. As far as the union collective bargaining, I do know that in the private sector where this is largely done, it is part of the collective bargaining process. In the wood products industry, you have some mills that are randomly drug tested. You have other mills that are not, that have no drug testing, and that's based on the collective bargaining process. So I would expect that they would have input in the rulemaking process should this go into effect. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Berger.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Close, what is the difference in the way it is right now? Because I know they can drug test, and it's not mandated. So what is the difference?
Chair Doyle, Representative Berger, this gives them the authority to do it in the statute. Right now we do not have that. They may be doing it in selected cases, but this gives them the authority to do that. And, Mr. Chair, I also forgot one thing. I wanted to show you on the attached to my testimony shows that the state of Virginia has just passed student drug testing for all students in the state of Virginia. So the states are beginning to move on student drug testing, and so I think it's only fair that those who work with students be under the same requirements, since that seems to be a trend.
Other questions? Representative, can you comment, I guess, just the what I'm picking up, at least from that DHS letter, was the concern about the expense of drug testing. It seems to me that, you know, that's an issue of priorities. I mean, it would seem to me that if something comes out where, you know, because of this drug use, that children are being put at risk, you know, what's the financial, I guess, cost of that versus, you know, having to do the test?
Chair Doyle, I agree. And again, if you're not mandating it, they can choose when they're going to do it, when they're not. There's also protection in the bill if they do the drug testing, that they're held harmless. So we're trying to protect them, protect the agencies, but allow them. And I see this as very limited in scope, only when there would be a very clear problem. And I'm assuming they would check with their attorneys before they would even do the drug testing. Okay. So it should be very limited.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Close, I'm looking specifically at Section 3 on the second page on the circumstances under which an employer would be authorized to conduct drug testing. And it looks like that there are four situations in which that can happen. The first one, I think I understand. The second one, I assume, refers to the court cases that we have seen about reasonable suspicion. I didn't see that defined somewhere else, and I may have just missed it. So I'm assuming that's what that's about. And the third, do we have a routine fitness for duty testing now, or medical routine medical examination requirements now for people who are involved with contact with children? I'm simply not aware.
Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, I do not know either, and that particular line was not requested by me. That's something Legislative Council put in. I'd be willing to remove that. I don't think that is needed.
Okay. And then number four, if I could follow up, Mr. Chair. Number four, follow-up testing. I'm assuming what we're talking about here is that somebody has been caught up in a situation in which they've been using drugs and they need some kind of remediation. Is that what your intention was? And then now they've had the remediation and we're going to find out if they're now drug-free.
Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, that is correct. I asked them to put in a last chance agreement clause. I'm assuming that's what they were after there. It has to do with if you sign an agreement that you'll be drug free, then they have the right to affirm that is the case.
I see. So this is in reference to that part. Thank you.
Yes. And also, I had intended that if there's an accident during work time, that is also cause of action under this.
That would also trigger the right to ask for an exam.
Accidents, yes.
Okay.
I don't see that.
Well, I can, Chair Doyle, I can only tell you that I have my memorandum here telling LC what is to be in this bill, and that is on there. So we are willing to amend it to make that more clear.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate your testimony, and I think in interest of time, you know, I've really enjoyed all the public employee folks being here, and first time I think this session. But Andrea Meyer, I'd like to call forward first, and if maybe there is one of the representatives of public employee unions that can come in and speak, and then I think the two others that have interest will be catching you when it comes up for next time. Sounds like there's going to be some amendments. Thanks for visiting.
All right. Good afternoon. For the record, Mr. Chair, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association, and we are here, we regret to say, in opposition to the bill. We believe it's unconstitutional, unnecessary, and expensive. And I'll start by talking about the constitutional issues that our attorney sees. And forgive me, I'm not an attorney, but I've been on the phone with mine for a while here. In Section 2 of the bill, the language provides that any employee could be drug tested, which our attorneys tell us is a Fourth Amendment violation regarding unreasonable searches and seizures. He said that the Ninth Circuit Court has been pretty clear and has taken a pretty strong stand on random searches, absent a compelling need such as a safety-sensitive position, such as someone operating a bus, a school bus, or airline pilots, train engineers, and so on. Additionally, other appellate and other circuits around the state, other appellate courts and other circuits around the country have taken a similar stance in most areas with respect to the kind of fishing expedition that a test, for example, during a physical might be for folks who have not exhibited any kind of cause that would trigger a reasonable suspicion on the part of an employer that there's an impairment or some kind of problem. So those are some of the constitutional issues that bother us about it. There was a bill like this in 1997 that was considered and then rejected only days after a pretty famous case, the Chandler decision, which some of you might remember. The state of Georgia made it a requirement that candidates for public office be drug tested because it seemed like a good idea. You know, if we're going to stand up for a drug-free America, then we ought to be able to walk our talk. Well, they decided that was unreasonably overbroad and an invasion of privacy with respect to, you know, absent cause, kind of an invasion of your privacy, and they did not restore that language. They overturned the law.
Laurie, if I can stop you just a moment. Do you have a distinction between public employees versus private sector employees in this constitutional argument?
Actually, there are courts that have made that distinction. In New York State, for example, there was they passed a law just drug testing teachers, and it was overturned by the Supreme Court there because they felt that when certified teachers go to work, they go to work for the government, and that's a monopoly in effect, and there is no other choice of employer. And so they did make that distinction explicitly in that particular case. We also have a concern with the analysis of a sample being an invasion of privacy for things other than what it was intended to find. For example, if someone were pregnant or were treating depression with some kind of antidepressant or so forth, all of those kinds of things turn up in a screening. And though the bill does say that the third party isn't supposed to reveal that to the employer, there is a sensitivity there, and that is, again, an invasion of privacy absent a cause. And finally, we believe that there's a second constitutional impairment in the penalties section of the bill because it superimposes a set of penalties over the contracts that are in force in 198 school districts and in other places that handle how individual districts and their employees mitigate these issues when there is a problem. With respect to the unnecessary part, probably the most important part of my testimony in my view, there is no law needed to grant the authority to do this. And as evidence of that, school districts all over Oregon are already pre-employment screening. And they also have the opportunity to screen, as I said, for safety-sensitive positions such as school bus drivers. And finally, if there is an impairment, if there's some reasonable suspicion that maybe somebody is using, an employer can have an employee, a school employee who's working with children or otherwise, undergo drug testing for cause. And so we believe that all of the rational, reasonable, common sense reasons you would ask an employee to do this are already in place and there is already right. And so this bill is simply unnecessary because, and I double-checked it after I saw the DHS letter, you know, they assert that they need the authority. And I called my attorney again and said, is that true that you need explicit statutory authority? And he said, no, that unless it's a violation of a constitutional right to do something, you don't need explicit statutory authority to have the right to do this. And so, and that's why you will see Salem Kaiser Public Schools, I believe, asks for pre-employment screening for their teachers, for example. Finally, it is our understanding that these tests can be very expensive, and the bill kindly doesn't impose that burden on the employee, but it does on school districts. And here we are in a financial crisis, and I'm thinking other public employee unions would feel the same way about other agencies as well. It's really not if it's a solution in search of a problem, why have why even encourage districts to feel the pressure to incur $60 to $120 per employee expense to undergo testing when you haven't demonstrated a compelling need to do so?
Okay, thank you. Andrew, did you have any comments? And if you do, you got about a minute and a half.
Mr. Doyle, members of the committee, Andrew Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. Actually, there are those in the ACLU who have encouraged me to come support this bill since it can be perceived by us as a Full Employment Act, but I'm not. I'm here in opposition. I need to cover with you the Fourth Amendment, which covers government, not private industry. So there is the one criteria. The Fourth Amendment is the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, and papers and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures, shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by an oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be searched. Let there be no question. Drug testing affects a search within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment and Fourteenth Amendment. The United States Supreme Court has stated it has universally been held that the collection and testing of urine is a search within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. And collection and testing of urine intrudes upon an expectation of privacy that society has long recognized as reasonable. This is an extremely intrusive search. And it is government action here, and you must have individualized suspicion of wrongdoing, probable cause, before you do this. Now, there are very limited, well-defined exceptions, but I wanted to note also the Chandler case. The rationale in that decision, again, the one that required those running for elected office, was the need for trust in their elected officials, that they trust in their elected officials, both their liberty, their safety, their economic well-being, and ultimately responsibility for law enforcement. Nevertheless, in an 8-1 decision, the court threw that out. This does not sweep in just schools. It sweeps in all state employees, which could be state hospital employees, state parks and recs, the governor's office, the attorney general's office, because they deal with children, and you all, because you have contact with children in your employment here. Additional factors. First of all, anyone seeking employment, for instance, dealing with kids, has a background check, and that includes a fingerprinting. So you're going to spot problems on the front end. Second of all, if someone's convicted of a crime and their license can be removed. So you've got, if they are using drugs and they're convicted of a crime, your license is yanked, you're covering it on that end as well.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
We're so close.
I'd like to ask the ACLU if they're aware of Florida's 2001 Drug-Free Workplace Act and if there's been lawsuits brought against Florida's Drug-Free Workplace Act.
Chair Doyle, Representative Close, I'm not familiar with that one or the other three ones, although I noticed, I think in your attachment, one was just recently passed, and I'm not aware of whether or not these have been challenged.
Okay. Follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
The Virginia law that requires it, and this does not require it, of course, of students, will the ACLU be taking on the Florida Act that requires student drug testing?
Chair Doyle, Representative Close, is an ACLU of Florida, and it would be up to them or national to determine whether they're challenging that, not the ACLU of Oregon, which I can only speak of. I certainly can inquire, but as to the status of whether there is litigation pending, not whether they are considering it and what the status of potential litigation is. And I'd be happy to get back to you on that.
It's Virginia, by the way.
Oh, and Virginia. I'm sorry, because you also mentioned Florida. So Virginia was just enacted in March 22nd. So if I'm looking, I'm just glancing, it's signed by the governor, Mark Warner, on 3/22/03.
Correct.
So I can't advise, I do not know the status. I'd be certainly happy to look into it, but with it just being signed, they might not have had a chance to fully analyze it and go through the process that we certainly have to go to, which isn't always the quickest.
But overall, do you know if there's been any court cases taken against Florida, Georgia, or Arizona?
Chair Doyle, Representative Close, I don't. Of course, they're in a different jurisdiction. They're not in the Ninth Circuit, but I am not familiar with their status of those three legislative enactments. Thank you.
Andrew, since we've interrupted your testimony and we're at 3 o'clock, I think what we'll do is go ahead and just cut it short here.
Chair Doyle, I was actually at the very near end.
Okay.
I just wanted to point out a few other quick things really very quickly. This includes blood tests, which is one of the most intrusive levels, piercing of the needle in the body. The test doesn't tell whether someone is currently under the influence. It may tell what their past is, and it also can tell very personal information about whether they're diabetic, epileptic, pregnant, on antidepressant. It reveals very personal information about people, which is why it's so invasive and why the courts have protected this.
So that's actually all the testimony.
Okay, thank you. And colleagues, it looks like we'll be continuing this discussion at another time, so if you don't mind holding back on questions, appreciate that, and we will close the public hearing on 3112, and we are adjourned.